and peace is to be on both sides for payment of 1,000 marks. It is a trifling ransom, Saxon, and thou wilt owe gratitude to the moderation which accepts of it in exchange for your persons. But mark, this extends not to the Jew Isaac.
Nor to the Jew Isaac's daughter, said the Templar, who had now joined them.
Neither, said Front de Boeuf, belong to this Saxon's company.
I were unworthy to be called Christian if they did, replied Athelstane.
Deal with the unbelievers as you list.
Neither does the ransom include the Lady Rowena, said de Bracy.
It shall never be said I was scared out of a fair prize without striking a blow for it.
Neither, said Front de Boeuf, does our treaty refer to this wretched jester, whom I retain that I may make him an example to every knave who turns jest into earnest.
The Lady Rowena, answered Athelstane, with the most steady countenance, is my affianced bride. I will be drawn by wild horses before I consent to part with her.
The slave Womba has this day saved the life of my father Cedric. I will lose mine ere a hair of his head be injured.
Thy affianced bride?
The Lady Rowena, the affianced bride of a vassal like thee, said de Bracy.
Saxon, thou dreamest that the days of thy 7 kingdoms are returned again. I tell thee, the princes of the House of Anjou confer not their wards on men of such lineage as thine.
My lineage, proud Norman, replied Athelstane, is drawn from a source more pure and ancient than that of a beggarly Frenchman, whose living is won by selling the blood of the thieves whom he assembles under his paltry standard. Kings were my ancestors, strong in war and wise in council, who every day feasted in their hall more hundreds than thou canst number individual followers, whose names have been sung by minstrels and their laws recorded by witinage moats, whose bones were interred amid the prayers of saints and over whose tombs minsters have been builded.
Thou hast it, de Bracy, said Front de Boeuf,
well pleased with the rebuff which his companion had received.
The Saxon hath hit thee fairly.
As fairly as a captive can strike, said de Bracy with apparent carelessness. For he whose hands are tied should have his tongue at freedom. But thy glibness of reply, comrade, rejoined he, speaking to Athelstane, will not win the freedom of the Lady Rowena. To this Athelstane, who had already made a longer speech than was his custom to do on any topic, however interesting, returned no answer. The conversation was interrupted by the arrival of a menial who announced that a monk demanded admittance at the postern gate.
In the name of St. Bennet, the prince of these bull-beggars, said Front de Boeuf, have we a real monk this time, or another imposture? Search him, slaves, for when you suffer a second imposter to be palmed upon you, I'll have your eyes torn out and hot coals put into the sockets.
Let me endure the extremity of your anger, my lord, said Gilles, if this be not a real shaveling. Your squire Jocelyn knows him well, and will vouch him to be Brother Ambrose, a monk in attendance upon the prior of Jorvaux.
Admit him, said Front de Boeuf. Most likely he brings us news from his jovial master. Surely the devil keeps holiday, and the priests are released from duty, that they are strolling thus wildly through the country. Remove these prisoners, and Saxon, think on what thou hast heard.
I claim, said Athelstane, an honourable imprisonment, with due care of my board and of my couch, as becomes my rank, and as is due to one who is in treaty for ransom. Moreover, I hold him that deems himself the best of you, bound to answer to me with his body for this aggression on my freedom. This defiance hath already been sent to thee by thy sewer. Thou underliest it, and art bound to answer me. There lies my glove.
I answer not the challenge of my prisoner, said Front de Boeuf. Nor shalt thou, Maurice de Bracy. Gilles, he continued, hang the Franklin's glove upon the tine of yonder branchy antlers. There shall it remain until he's a free man. Should he then presume to demand it, or to affirm that he was unlawfully made my prisoner, by the belt of St. Christopher he will speak to one who hath never refused to meet a foe on foot or on horseback, alone or with his vassals at his back.
The Saxon prisoners were accordingly removed, just as they introduced the monk Ambrose, who appeared to be in great perturbation.
"This is the real Deus Vobiscum," said Womba, as he passed the reverend brother. "The others were but counterfeits." "Holy Mother," said the monk as he addressed the assembled knights, "am I at last safe and in Christian keeping?"
"Safe thou art," replied de Bracy, "and for Christianity here is the stout Baron Reginald Front de Boeuf, whose utter abomination is a Jew, and the good Knight Templar, Brian de Bois Guilbert, whose trade it is to slay Saracens. If these are not good marks of Christianity, I know no other which they bear about them."
"Ye are friends and allies of our reverend father in God, Aymar, prior of Jorvaux," said the monk, without noticing the tone of de Bracy's reply. "You owe him aid both by knightly faith and holy charity, for what saith the blessed St. Augustine in his treatise De Civitate Dei?"
"What saith the devil?" interrupted Front de Boeuf. "Or rather, what dost thou say, sir priest? We have little time to hear texts from the holy fathers."
"Sancta Maria!" ejaculated Father Ambrose. "How prompt to ire are these unhallowed laymen! But be it known to you, brave knights, that certain murderous caitiffs, casting behind them fear of God and reverence of his church, and not regarding the bull of the Holy See, si quis suadente diabolo—"
"Brother priest," said the Templar, "all this we know or guess at. Tell us plainly, is thy master, the prior, made prisoner, and to whom?"
"Surely," said Ambrose, "he is in the hands of the men of Belial, infestors of these woods, and contemners of the holy text, Touch not thou mine anointed, and do my prophets naught of evil."
"Here is a new argument for our swords, sirs," said Front de Boeuf, turning to his companions. "And so, instead of reaching us any assistance, the prior of Jorvaux requests aid at our hands. A man is well helped of these lazy churchmen when he hath most to do. But speak out, priest, and speak at once. What doth thy master expect from us?"
"So please you," said Ambrose, "violent hands having been imposed on my reverend superior, contrary to the holy ordinance which I did already quote, and the men of Belial having rifled his mails and budgets, and stripped him of 200 marks of pure refined gold, they do yet demand of him a large sum beside, ere they will suffer him to depart from their uncircumcised hands. Wherefore, the reverend father in God prays you, as his dear friends and allies, to rescue him, either by paying down the ransom at which they hold him, or by force of arms, at your best discretion."
"The foul fiend quell the prior," said Front de Boeuf. "His morning's draught has been a deep one. When did thy master ever hear of a Norman baron unbuckling his purse to relieve a churchman whose bags are 10 times as weighty as ours? And how can we do aught by valour that are cooped up here by 10 times our number and expect an assault every moment?"
"And that was what I was about to tell you," said the monk, "had your hastiness allowed me time. But, God help me, I am old, and these foul onslaughts distract an old man's brain. Nevertheless, it is of verity that they assemble a camp and raise a bank against the walls of this castle."
"To the battlements," cried de Bracy, "and let us mark what these knaves do without."
And so saying, he opened a latticed window which led to a sort of bartizan or projecting balcony, and immediately called from thence to those in the apartment.
"Saint-Denis, but the old monk, hath brought true tidings. They bring forward mantlets and pavise, and the archers muster on the skirts of the wood like a dark cloud before a hailstorm."
Reginald Front de Boeuf also looked out upon the field, and immediately snatched his bugle, and, after winding a long and loud blast, commanded his men to their posts on the walls.
"De Bracy, look to the eastern side, where the walls are lowest. Noble Bois Guilbert, thy trade has well taught thee how to attack and defend. Look thou to the western side. I myself will take post at the barbican. Yet do not confine your exertions to any one spot, noble friends. We must this day be everywhere, and multiply ourselves, were it possible, so as to carry by our presence succour and relief wherever the attack is hottest. Our numbers are few, but activity and courage may supply that defect, since we have only to do with rascal clowns."
"But, noble knights,"
exclaimed Father Ambrose amid the bustle and confusion occasioned by the preparations for defence.
"Will none of you hear the message of the Reverend Father and God Aymer, Prior of Jorvaux? I beseech thee to hear me, noble Sir Reginald."
"Go patter thy petitions to heaven," said the fierce Norman, "for we on earth have no time to listen to them. Ho, there, Anselm! See that seething pitch and oil are ready to pour on the heads of these audacious traitors. Look that the crossbowmen lack not bolts. Fling abroad my banner with the old bull's head. The knaves shall soon find with whom they have to do this day."
"But, noble sir,"
continued the monk, persevering in his endeavour to draw attention,
"consider my vow of obedience, and let me discharge myself of my superior's errand."
"Away with this prating dotard, fellows," said Front de Boeuf. "Lock him up in the chapel, to bid his beads till the broil be over. It will be a new thing to the saints in Torquilstone to hear aves and paters. They have not been often so honoured, I trow, since they were cut out of stone."
"Blaspheme not the holy saints, Sir Reginald," said de Bracy. "We shall have need of their aid today before yon rascal rout disband."
"I expect little aid from their hand," said Front de Boeuf, "unless we were to hurl them from the battlements on the heads of the villains. There's a huge, lumbering St. Christopher yonder, sufficient to bear a whole company to the earth."
The Templar, in the meantime, had been looking out on the proceedings of the besiegers with rather more attention than the brutal Front de Boeuf or his giddy companion.
"By the faith of mine order," he said,
"these men approach with more touch of discipline than could have been judged, howsoever they come by it. See how dexterously they avail themselves of every cover which a tree or bush affords, and shun exposing themselves to the shot of our crossbows. I spy neither banner nor pennon amongst them, and yet will I gauge my golden chain that they are led on by some noble or gentleman skilful in the practice of wars."
"I espy him," said de Bracy. "I see the waving of a knight's crest and the gleam of his armour. See yon tall man in the black mail who is busied marshalling the farther troop of the Rascai yeoman. By Saint-Denis, I hold him to be the same whom we called Le Noir Fainéant, who overthrew thee, Front de Boeuf, in the lists at Ashby."
"So much the better," said Front de Boeuf, "that he comes here to give me my revenge. Some hilding fella he must be, who dared not stay to assert his claim to a prize which chance had assigned him. I should have in vain sought for him where knights and nobles seek their foes, and right glad am I he hath here shown himself among yon villain yeomanry."
The demonstrations of the enemy's immediate approach cut off all farther discourse. Each knight repaired to his post, and at the head of the few followers whom they were able to muster, and who were in numbers inadequate to defend the whole circuit of the walls, they awaited with calm determination the threatened assault. Chapter 14. This wandering race, severed from other men, boast yet their intercourse with human arts. The seas, the woods, the deserts which they haunt, find them acquainted with their secret treasures, and unregarded herbs and flowers and blossoms display undreamed of powers when gathered by them. The Jew. Our history must needs retrograde for the space of a few pages to inform the reader of certain passages material to his understanding the rest of this important narrative. His own intelligence may indeed have easily anticipated that, when Ivanhoe sunk down and seemed abandoned by all the world, it was the importunity of Rebecca which prevailed on her father to have the gallant young warrior transported from the lists to the house which, for the time, the Jews inhabited in the suburbs of Ashby. It would not have been difficult to have persuaded Isaac to this step in any other circumstances, for his disposition was kind and grateful, but he had also the prejudices and scrupulous timidity of his persecuted people, and those were to be conquered.
"Holy Abraham!" he exclaimed. "It is a good youth, and my heart bleeds to see the gore trickle down his rich embroidered hacqueton and his corselet of goodly price. But to carry him to our home, damsel, hast thou well considered? He is a Christian, and by our law we may not deal with the stranger and Gentile, save for the advantage of our commerce.
Speak not so, my dear father, replied Rebecca. We may not, indeed, mix with them in banquet and in jollity, but in wounds and in misery, the Gentile becometh the Jew's brother.
I would I knew what the Rabbi Jacob ben Tudela would opine on it, replied Isaac. Nevertheless, the good youth must not bleed to death. Let Seth and Reuben bear him to Ashby.
Nay, let them place him in my litter, said Rebecca. I will mount one of the palfreys.
That were to expose thee to the gaze of these dogs of Ishmael and of Edom, whispered Isaac with a suspicious glance towards the crowd of knights and squires.
But Rebecca was already busied in carrying her charitable purpose into effect, and listed not what he said, until Isaac, seizing the sleeve of her mantle, again exclaimed in a hurried voice,
Beard of Aaron, what if the youth perish? If he die in our custody, shall we not be held guilty of his blood and torn to pieces by the multitude?
He will not die, my father, said Rebecca, gently extricating herself from the grasp of Isaac. He will not die unless we abandon him, and if so, we were indeed answerable for his blood to God and to man.
Nay, said Isaac, releasing his hold, it grieveth me as much to see the drops of his blood as if there were so many golden besants from mine own purse. And I well know that the lessons of Miriam, daughter of the Rabbi Manassas of Byzantium, whose soul is in paradise, have made thee skilful in the art of healing, and that thou knowest the craft of herbs and the force of elixirs. Therefore do as thy mind giveth thee. Thou art a good damsel, and a blessing, and a crown, and a song of rejoicing unto me and unto my house, and unto the people of my fathers.
The apprehensions of Isaac, however, were not ill-founded, and the generous and grateful benevolence of his daughter exposed her, on her return to Ashby, to the unhallowed gaze of Brian de Bois-Guilbert. The Templar twice passed and repassed them on the road, fixing his bold and ardent look on the beautiful Jewess, and we have already seen the consequences of the admiration which her charms excited when accident threw her into the power of that unprincipled voluptuary. Rebecca lost no time in causing the patient to be transported to their temporary dwelling, and proceeded with her own hands to examine and to bind up his wounds. The youngest reader of romances and romantic ballads must recollect how often the females, during the Dark Ages, as they are called, were initiated into the mysteries of surgery, and how frequently the gallant knight submitted the wounds of his person to her cure, whose eyes had yet more deeply penetrated his heart. But the Jews, both male and female, possessed and practised the medical science in all its branches, and the monarchs and powerful barons of the time frequently committed themselves to the charge of some experienced sage among this despised people when wounded or in sickness. The aid of the Jewish physicians was not the less eagerly sought after, though a general belief prevailed among the Christians that the Jewish rabbins were deeply acquainted with the occult sciences, and particularly with the Kabbalistical art, which had its name and origin in the studies of the sages of Israel. Neither did the rabbins disown such acquaintance with supernatural arts, which added nothing, for what could add aught, to the hatred with which their nation was regarded, while it diminished the contempt with which that malevolence was mingled. A Jewish magician might be the subject of equal abhorrence with a Jewish usurer, but he could not be equally despised. It is besides probable, considering the wonderful cures they are said to have performed, that the Jews possessed some secrets of the healing art peculiar to themselves, and which, with the exclusive spirit arising out of their condition, they took great care to conceal from the Christians amongst whom they dwelt. The beautiful Rebecca had been heedfully brought up in all the knowledge proper to her nation, which her apt and powerful mind had retained, arranged, and enlarged in the course of a progress beyond her years, her sex, and even the age in which she lived. Her knowledge of medicine and of the healing art had been acquired under an aged Jewess, the daughter of one of their most celebrated doctors, who loved Rebecca as her daughter and was believed to have communicated to her secrets which had been left to herself by her sage father. The fate of Miriam had indeed been to fall a sacrifice to the fanaticism of the times, but her secrets had survived in her apt pupil. Rebecca, thus endowed with knowledge as with beauty, was universally revered and admired by her own tribe, who almost regarded her as one of those gifted women mentioned in the sacred history. Her father himself, out of a sort of reverence for her talents, which involuntarily mingled itself with his unbounded affection, permitted the maiden a greater liberty than was usually indulged to those of her sex by the habits of their people, and was, as we have just seen, frequently guided by her opinion, even in preference to his own. When Ivanhoe reached the habitation of Isaac, he was still in a state of unconsciousness, owing to the profuse loss of blood which had taken place during his exertions in the lists. Rebecca examined the wound, and having applied to it such vulnerary remedies as her art prescribed, informed her father that if fever could be averted, of which the great bleeding rendered her little apprehensive, and if the healing balsam of Miriam retained its virtue, there was nothing to fear for his guest's life, and that he might with safety travel to York with them on the ensuing day. Isaac looked a little blank at this annunciation. His charity would willingly have stopped short at Ashby, or at most would have left the wounded Christian to be tended in the house where he was residing at present, with an assurance to the Hebrew to whom it belonged that all expenses should be duly discharged. To this, however, Rebecca opposed many reasons, of which we shall only mention two that had peculiar weight with Isaac. The one was that she would on no account put her phial of precious balsam into the hands of another physician, even of her own tribe, lest that valuable mystery should be discovered. The other, that this wounded knight, Wilfred of Ivanhoe, was an intimate favourite of Richard Coeur de Lion, and that, in case the monarch should return, Isaac, who had supplied his brother John with treasure to prosecute his rebellious purposes, would stand in no small need of a powerful protector who enjoyed Richard's favour.
"Thou art speaking but sooth, Rebecca," said Isaac, giving way to these weighty arguments. "It were an offending of heaven to betray the secrets of the blessed Miriam, for the good which heaven giveth us is not rashly to be squandered upon others, whether it be talents of gold and shekels of silver, or whether it be the secret mysteries of a wise physician. Assuredly they should be preserved to those to whom Providence hath vouchsafed them. And him whom the Nazarenes of England called the Lion's Heart, assuredly it were better for me to fall into the hands of a strong lion of Idumea than into his, if he shall have assurance of my dealing with his brother. Wherefore I will lend ear to thy counsel, and this youth shall journey with us unto York, and our house shall be as a home to him until his wounds shall be healed. And if he of the lion's heart shall return to the land, as is now noised abroad, then shall this Wilfred of Ivanhoe be unto me as a wall of defence, when the king's displeasure shall burn high against thy father. And if he doth not return, this Wilfred may natheless repay us our charges when he shall gain treasure by the strength of his spear and of his sword, even as he did yesterday and this day also. For the youth is a good youth, and keepeth the day which he appointeth, and restoreth that which he borroweth, and succoureth the Israelite, even the child of my father's house, when he is encompassed by strong thieves and sons of Belial."
It was not until evening was nearly closed that Ivanhoe was restored to consciousness of his situation. He awakened from a broken slumber, under the confused impressions which are naturally attendant on the recovery from a state of insensibility. He was unable for some time to recall exactly to memory the circumstances which had preceded his fall in the lists, or to make out any connected chain of the events in which he had been engaged upon the yesterday. A sense of wound and injury, joined to great weakness and exhaustion, was mingled with the recollection of blows dealt and received, of steeds rushing upon each other, overthrowing and overthrown, of shouts and clashing of arms, and all the heady tumult of a confused fight. An effort to draw aside the curtain of his couch was in some degree successful, although rendered difficult by the pain of his wound. To his great surprise, he found himself in a room magnificently furnished, but having cushions instead of chairs to rest upon, and in other respects partaking so much of Oriental costume that he began to doubt whether he had not been, during his sleep, transported back again to the land of Palestine. The impression was increased when, the tapestry being drawn aside, a female form dressed in a rich habit, which partook more of the Eastern taste than that of Europe, glided through the door which it concealed, and was followed by a swarthy domestic. As the wounded knight was about to address this fair apparition, she imposed silence by placing her slender finger on her ruby lip, while the attendant approaching him proceeded to uncover Ivanhoe's side, and the lovely Jewess satisfied herself that the bandage was in its place and the wound doing well. She performed her task with a graceful and dignified simplicity and modesty, which might, even in more civilized days, have served to redeem it from whatever might seem repugnant to female delicacy. The idea of so young and beautiful a person engaged in attendance on the sick bed and in dressing the wound of one of a different sex was melted away and lost in that of a beneficent being contributing her effectual aid to relieve pain and to avert the stroke of death. Rebecca's few and brief directions were given in the Hebrew language to the old domestic, and he, who had been frequently her assistant in similar cases, obeyed them without reply. The accents of an unknown tongue, however harsh they might have sounded when uttered by another, had, coming from the beautiful Rebecca, the romantic and pleasing effect which fancy ascribes to the charms pronounced by some beneficent fairy, unintelligible indeed to the ear, but from the sweetness of utterance and benignity of aspect which accompany them, touching and affecting to the heart. Without, then, making an attempt at further question, Ivanhoe suffered them in silence to take the measures they thought most proper for his recovery, and it was not until these were completed, and his kind physician about to retire, that his curiosity could no longer be suppressed. "Gentle maiden," he began in the Arabian tongue, with which his Eastern travels had rendered him familiar, and which he thought most likely to be understood by the turbaned and caftan damsel who stood before him, "I pray you, gentle maiden, of your courtesy." But here he was interrupted by his fair physician, a smile which she could scarce suppress, dimpling for an instant, a face whose general expression was that of contemplative melancholy. "I am of England, Sir Knight, and speak the English tongue, although my dress and my lineage belong to another climate." "Noble damsel," again the Knight of Ivanhoe began, and again Rebecca hastened to interrupt him. "Bestow not on me, Sir Knight," she said, "the epithet of noble. It is well you should speedily know that your handmaiden is a poor Jewess, the daughter of that Isaac of York to whom you were so lately a good and a kind lord. It well becomes him and those of his household to render to you such careful tendance as your present state necessarily demands." I know not whether the fair Rowena would have been altogether satisfied with the species of emotion with which her devoted knight had hitherto gazed on the beautiful features and fair form and lustrous eyes of the lovely Rebecca, eyes whose brilliancy was shaded, and, as it were, mellowed by the shade of her long, dark, silken eyelashes, and which a minstrel would have compared to the evening star darting its rays through a bower of jessamine. But Ivanhoe was too good a Catholic to retain the same class of feelings towards a Jewess. This Rebecca had foreseen, and for this very purpose she had hastened to mention her father's name and lineage. Yet, for the fair and wise daughter of Isaac was not without a touch of female weakness, she could not but sigh internally when the glance of respectful admiration, not altogether unmixed with tenderness, with which Ivanhoe had hitherto regarded his unknown benefactress, was exchanged at once for a manner cold composed and collected, and fraught with no deeper feeling than that which expressed a grateful sense of courtesy received from an unexpected quarter and one of an inferior race. It was not that Ivanhoe's former carriage expressed more than that general devotional homage which youth always pays to beauty, yet it was mortifying that one word should operate as a spell to remove poor Rebecca, who could not be supposed altogether ignorant of her title to such homage, to a degraded class to whom it could not be honourably rendered. But the gentleness and candour of Rebecca's nature imputed no fault to Ivanhoe for sharing in the universal prejudices of his age and religion. On the contrary, the fair Jewess, though sensible her patient now regarded her as one of a race of reprobation, with whom it was disgraceful to hold any beyond the most necessary intercourse, ceased not to pay the same patient and devoted attention to his safety and convenience. She informed him of the necessity they were under of removing to York, and of her father's resolution to transport him thither, and tend him in his own house until his health should be restored. Ivanhoe expressed great repugnance to this plan, which he grounded on unwillingness to give farther trouble to his benefactors. "Was there not," he said, "in Ashby or near it some Saxon franklin or even some wealthy peasant who would endure the burthen of a wounded countryman's residence with him until he should be again able to bear his armour? Was there no convent of Saxon endowment where he could be received, or could he not be transported as far as Burton, where he was sure to find hospitality with Waltheof, the abbot of St. Witold's, to whom he was related?" "Any the worse of these harbourages," said Rebecca with a melancholy smile, "would unquestionably be more fitting for your residence than the abode of a despised Jew. Yet, Sir Knight, unless you would dismiss your physician, you cannot change your lodging. Our nation, as you well know, can cure wounds, though we deal not in inflicting them, and in our own family in particular are secrets which have been handed down since the days of Solomon, and of which you have already in part experienced the advantage. No, Nazarene, I crave your forgiveness, no Christian leech within the four seas of Britain could enable you to bear your corslet within a month." "And how soon wilt thou enable me to brook it?" said Ivanhoe impatiently. "Within 8 days, if thou wilt be patient and conformable to my directions," replied Rebecca. "By our Blessed Lady," said Wilfred, "if it be not a sin to name her here, it is no time for me or any true knight to be bedridden. And if thou accomplish thy promise, maiden, I will pay thee with my cask full of crowns, come by them as I may." "And I will accomplish my promise," said Rebecca, "and thou shalt bear thine armour on the 8th day from hence, if thou wilt grant me but one boon in the stead of the silver thou hast promised me." "If it be within my power, and such as a true Christian knight may grant to one of thy people," replied Ivanhoe, "I will grant thy boon blithely and thankfully." "Nay," answered Rebecca, "I will but pray of thee to believe henceforward that a Jew may do good service to a Christian without other guerdon than the blessing of the great Father who made both Jew and Gentile." "It were sin to doubt it, maiden," replied Ivanhoe, "and I repose myself on thy skill without further doubt or question, well trusting you will enable me to bear my corselet on the 8th day. And now, my kind leech, let me inquire of the news abroad. What of the noble Saxon Cedric and his household? What of the lovely lady—" He stopped, as if unwilling to speak Rowena's name in the house of a Jew. "Of her, I mean, who was named Queen of the Tournament." "And who was selected by you, Sir Knight, to hold that dignity, with judgment which was admired as much as your valour," replied Rebecca. The blood which Ivanhoe had lost did not prevent a flush from crossing his cheek, feeling that he had incautiously betrayed the interest he had in Rowena by the awkward attempt he had made to conceal it. "It was less of her I would speak," said he, "than of Prince John, and I would fain know somewhat of a faithful squire, and why he now attends me not." "Let me use my authority as a leech," answered Rebecca, "and enjoin you to keep silence and avoid agitating reflections, whilst I apprise you of what you desire to know. Prince John hath broken off the tournament, and set forward in all haste towards York, with the nobles, knights, and churchmen of his party, after collecting such sums as they could wring, by fair means or foul, from those who are esteemed the wealthy of the land. It is said he designs to assume his brother's crown.
"Not without a blow struck in its defence," said Ivanhoe, raising himself on the couch. "If there were but one true subject in England, I will fight for Richard's title with the best of them, aye, 1-2 in his just quarrel."
"But that you may be able to do so," said Rebecca, touching his shoulder with her hand, "you must now observe my directions and remain quiet."
"True, maiden," said Ivanhoe, "as quiet as these disquieted times will permit. And of Cedric and his household?"
"His steward came but brief while since," said the Jewess, "panting with haste, to ask my father for certain monies, the price of wool, the growth of Cedric's flocks, and from him I learned that Cedric and Athelstane of Coningsborough had left the prince's banquet in high displeasure, and were about to set forth on their return homeward."
"Went any lady with them to the banquet?" said Wilfred.
"The Lady Rowena," said Rebecca, answering the question with more precision than it had been asked, "the Lady Rowena went not to the prince's feast, and, as the steward reported to us, she is now on her journey back to Rotherwood with her guardian Cedric. And touching your faithful squire, Girth—"
"Ha!" exclaimed the knight, "knowest thou his name? But thou dost," he immediately added, "and well thou mayest, for it was from thy hands, and, as I think, from thine own generosity of spirit, that he received but yesterday 100 zecchins.
"Speak not of that," said Rebecca, blushing deeply. "I see how easy it is for the tongue to betray what the heart would blithely conceal."
"But this sum of gold," said Ivanhoe gravely, "my honour is concerned in repaying it to your father."
"Let it be as thou wilt," said Rebecca, "when 8 days have passed away. But think not, and speak not now, of aught that may retard thy recovery."
"Be it so, kind maiden," said Ivanhoe. "I were most ungrateful to dispute thy commands. But one word of the fate of poor Girth, and I have done with questioning thee."
"I grieve to tell thee, Sir Knight," answered the Jewess, "that he is in custody by the orders of Cedric." And then, observing the distress which her communication gave to Wilfred, she instantly added, "But the steward Oswald said that if nothing occurred to renew his master's displeasure against him, he was sure that Cedric would pardon Girth, a faithful serf, and one who stood high in favour, and who had but committed this error out of the love that he bore to Cedric's son. And he said, moreover, that he and his comrades, and especially Wamba the jester, were resolved to warn Girth to make his escape by the way, in case Cedric's ire against him could not be mitigated."
"Would to God they may keep their purpose," said Ivanhoe. "But it seems as if I were destined to bring ruin on whomsoever hath shown kindness to me. My king, by whom I was honoured and distinguished, thou seest that the brother most indebted to him is raising his arm to grasp his crown. My regard hath brought restraint and trouble on one of the fairest of her sex, and now my father in his mood may slay this poor bondsman, but for his love and loyal service to me. Thou seest, maiden, what an ill-fated wretch thou dost labour to assist. Be wise, and let me go, ere the misfortunes which track my footsteps like slot-hounds shall involve thee also in their pursuit."
"Nay," said Rebecca, "thy weakness and thy grief, Sir Knight, make thee unjustly miscalculate the purposes of heaven. Thou hast been restored to thy country when it most needed the assistance of a strong hand and a true heart. Thou hast humbled the pride of thine enemies and those of thy king when thy horn was most highly exalted. And for the evil which thou hast sustained, seest thou not that heaven has raised thee a helper and physician, even among the most despised of the land? Therefore be of good courage, and trust that thou art preserved for some marvel which thine arm shall work before this people. Adieu, and having taken the medicine which I shall send thee by the hand of Reuben, compose thyself again to rest. that thou mayst be the more able to endure the journey on the succeeding day. Ivanhoe was convinced by the reasoning, and obeyed the directions of Rebecca. The draught which Reuben administered was of a sedative and narcotic quality, and secured the patient sound and undisturbed slumbers. In the morning, his kind physician found him entirely free from feverish symptoms and fit to undergo the fatigue of a journey. He was deposited in the horse litter which had brought him from the lists, and every precaution taken for his travelling with ease. In one circumstance only, even the entreaties of Rebecca were unable to secure sufficient attention to the accommodation of the wounded traveller. Isaac, like the enriched traveller of Juvenal's tenth satire, had ever the fear of robbery before his eyes, conscious that he would be alike accounted fair game by the marauding Norman noble and by the Saxon outlaw. He therefore journeyed at a great rate, and made short halts and shorter repasts, so that he passed by Cedric and Athelstane, who had several hours the start of him, but had been delayed by their protracted feasting at the convent of St. Witold's. Yet such was the virtue of Miriam's balsam, or such the strength of Ivanhoe's constitution, that he did not sustain from the hurried journey that inconvenience which his kind physician had apprehended. In another point of view, however, the Jew's haste proved somewhat more than good speed. The rapidity with which he insisted upon travelling bred several disputes betwixt him and the party whom he had hired to attend him as a guard. These men were Saxons, and not free by any means from the national love of ease and good living which the Normans stigmatised as laziness and gluttony. Reversing Shylock's position, they had accepted the employment in hopes of feeding upon the wealthy Jew, and were very much displeased when they found themselves disappointed by the rapidity with which he insisted on their proceeding. They remonstrated also upon the risk of damage to their horses by these forced marches. Finally, there arose betwixt Isaac and his satellites a deadly feud concerning the quantity of wine and ale to be allowed for consumption at each meal. And thus it happened that when the alarm of danger approached, and that which Isaac feared was likely to come upon him, he was deserted by the discontented mercenaries on whose protection he had relied, without using the means necessary to secure their attachment. In this deserted condition, the Jew, with his daughter and her wounded patient, was found by Cedric, as has already been noticed, and soon afterwards fell into the power of de Bracy and his confederates. Little notice was at first taken of the horse litter, and it might have remained behind, but for the curiosity of de Bracy, who looked into it under the impression that it might contain the object of his enterprise, for Rebecca had not unveiled herself. But de Bracy's astonishment was considerable when he discovered that the litter contained a wounded man, who, conceiving himself to have fallen into the power of Saxon outlaws, with whom his name might be a protection for himself and his friends, frankly avowed himself to be Wilfred of Ivanhoe. The ideas of chivalrous honour, which amidst his wildness and levity never utterly abandoned de Bracy, prohibited him from doing the knight any injury in his defenceless condition, and equally interdicted his betraying him to Front de Boeuf, who would have no scruples to put to death, under any circumstances, the rival claimant of the fief of Ivanhoe. On the other hand, to liberate a rival preferred by the Lady Rowena, and indeed Wilfred's previous banishment from his father's house had made matter of notoriety, was a pitch far above the flight of de Bracy's generosity. A middle course, betwixt good and evil, was all which he found himself capable of adopting, and he commanded two of his own squires to keep close by the litter and to suffer no one to approach it. If questioned, they were directed by their master to say that the empty litter of the Lady Rowena was employed to transport one of their comrades who had been wounded in the scuffle. On arriving at Torquilstone, while the Knight Templar and the Lord of that castle were each intent upon their own schemes, the one on the Jew's treasure and the other on his daughter, de Bracy's squires conveyed Ivanhoe, still under the name of a wounded comrade, to a distant apartment. This was accordingly returned by de Bracy's squires to Front de Boeuf, when he questioned them why they did not make for the battlements upon the alarm.
"A wanted companion!"
he replied in great wrath and astonishment.
"No wonder the churls and yeomen wax so presumptuous as even to lay leaguer before castles, and the clowns and swineherds send defiances to nobles, since men-at-arms have turned sick men's nurses, and free companions are grown keepers of dying folks' curtains when the castle is about to be assailed. To the battlements, you loitering villains!"
he exclaimed, raising his stentorian voice till the arches around rung again.
"To the battlements! I will splinter your bones with this truncheon!"
The men sulkily replied that they desired nothing better than to go to the battlements, providing Front de Boeuf would bear them out with their master, who had commanded them to tend the dying man.
"The dying man, knaves!" rejoined the baron. "I promise thee we shall all be dying men, and we stand not to it the more stoutly. But I will relieve the guard upon this caitiff companion of yours. Here, Ulfred, hag, fiend of a Saxon witch, hearest thou not? Tend me this bedridden fella, since he must needs be tended, whilst these knaves use their weapons. Here be two arblasts, comrade, with windlasses and quarrels. To the barbican with you, and see you drive each bolt through a Saxon brain."
The men, who, like most of their description, were fond of enterprise and detested inaction, went joyfully to the scene of danger, as they were commanded, and thus the charge of Ivanhoe was transferred to Ulfred, or Ulrica. But she, whose brain was burning with remembrance of injuries and with hopes of vengeance, was readily induced to devolve upon Rebecca the care of her patient. Chapter 15. "Ascend the watchtower yonder, valiant soldier. Look on the field and say how goes the battle." Schiller's Maid of Orleans. A moment of peril is often also a moment of open-hearted kindness and affection. We are thrown off our guard by the general agitation of our feelings, and betray the intensity of those which, at more tranquil moments, our prudence at least conceals, if it cannot altogether suppress them. In finding herself once more by the side of Ivanhoe, Rebecca was astonished at the keen sensation of pleasure which she experienced, even in a moment when all around them both was danger, if not despair. As she felt his pulse and inquired after his health, there was a softness in her touch and in her accents, implying a kinder interest than she would herself have been pleased to have voluntarily expressed. Her voice faltered, and her hand trembled, and it was only the cold question of Ivanhoe, "Is it you, gentle maiden?" which recalled her to herself, and reminded her the sensations which she felt were not, and could not, be mutual. A sigh escaped, but it was scarce audible, and the questions which she put to the knight concerning his state of health were put in the tone of calm friendship. Ivanhoe answered her hastily that he was, in point of health, as well and better than he could have expected. "Thanks," he said, "dear Rebecca, to thy helpful skill." "He calls me dear Rebecca," said the maiden to herself, "but it is in the cold and careless tone which ill suits the word. His war horse, his hunting hound, were dearer to him than the despised Jewess." "My mind, gentle maiden," continued Ivanhoe, "is more disturbed by anxiety than my body with pain. From the speeches of these men who were my warders just now, I learn that I am a prisoner, and if I judge aright of the loud, hoarse voice which even now dispatched them hence on some military duty, I am in the castle of Front de Boeuf. If so, how will this end? Or how can I protect Rowena and my father?" "He names not the Jew or Jewess," said Rebecca internally. "Yet what is our portion in him, and how justly am I punished by heaven for letting my thoughts dwell upon him?" She hastened, after this brief self-accusation, to give Ivanhoe what information she could, but it amounted only to this, that the Templar Bois-Guilbert and the Baron Front de Boeuf were commanders within the castle, that it was beleaguered from without, but by whom she knew not, She added that there was a Christian priest within the castle who might be possessed of more information. "A Christian priest," said the knight joyfully. "Fetch him hither, Rebecca, if thou canst. Say a sick man desires his ghostly counsel. Say what thou wilt, but bring him. Something I must do or attempt, but how can I determine until I know how matters stand without?" Rebecca, in compliance with the wishes of Ivanhoe, made that attempt to bring Cedric into the wounded knight's chamber, which was defeated, as we have already seen, by the interference of Urfrid, who had been also on the watch to intercept the supposed monk. Rebecca retired to communicate to Ivanhoe the failure of her errand. They had not much leisure to regret the failure of this source of intelligence, or to contrive by what means it might be supplied, for the noise within the castle, occasioned by the defensive preparations which had been considerable for some time, now increased into tenfold bustle and clamour. The heavy yet hasty step of the men-at-arms traversed the battlements or resounded on the narrow and winding passages and stairs which led to the various bartizans and points of defence. The voices of the knights were heard, animating their followers or directing measures of defence, while their commands were often drowned in the clashing of armour or the clamorous shouts of those whom they addressed. Tremendous as these sounds were, and yet more terrible from the awful event which they presaged, there was a sublimity mixed with them, which Rebecca's high-toned mind could feel even in that moment of terror. Her eye kindled, although the blood fled from her cheeks, and there was a strange mixture of fear and of a thrilling sense of the sublime as she repeated, half whispering to herself, half speaking to her companion, the sacred text. "The quiver rattleth, the glittering spear and the shield, the noise of the captains and the shouting." But Ivanhoe was like the warhorse of that sublime passage, glowing with impatience at his inactivity and with his ardent desire to mingle in the affray of which these sounds were the introduction. "If I could but drag myself," he said, "to yonder window, that I might see how this brave game is like to go, if I had but bow to shoot a shaft or battle-axe to strike, were it but a single blow for our deliverance. It is in vain, it is in vain. I am alike nerveless and weaponless." "Fret not thyself, noble knight," answered Rebecca. "The sounds have ceased of a sudden. It may be they join not battle." "Thou knowest naught of it," said Wilfred impatiently. "This dead pause only shows that the men are at their posts on the walls and expecting an instant attack. What we have heard was but the distant muttering of the storm. It will burst anon in all its fury. Could I but reach yonder window!" "Thou wilt but injure thyself by the attempt, noble knight," replied his attendant. Observing his extreme solicitude, she firmly added, "I myself will stand at the lattice and describe to you as I can what passes without." "You must not, you shall not," exclaimed Ivanhoe. "Each lattice, each aperture will be soon a mark for the archers. Some random shaft—" "It shall be welcome," murmured Rebecca, as with firm pace she ascended two or three steps which led to the window of which they spoke. "Rebecca, dear Rebecca," exclaimed Ivanhoe, "this is no maiden's pastime. Do not expose thyself to wounds and death, and render me forever miserable for having given the occasion. At least cover thyself with yonder ancient buckler, and show as little of your person at the lattice as may be." Following with wonderful promptitude the directions of Ivanhoe, and availing herself of the protection of the large ancient shield, which she placed against the lower part of the window, Rebecca, with tolerable security to herself, could witness part of what was passing without the castle, and report to Ivanhoe the preparations which the assailants were making for the storm. Indeed, the situation which she thus obtained was peculiarly favourable for this purpose, because, being placed in an angle of the main building, Rebecca could not only see what passed beyond the precincts of the castle, but also commanded a view of the outwork, likely to be the first object of the meditated assault. It was an exterior fortification of no great height or strength, intended to protect the postern gate, through which Cedric had been recently dismissed by Front de Boeuf. The castle moat divided this species of barbican from the rest of the fortress, so that, in case of its being taken, it was easy to cut off the communication with the main building by withdrawing the temporary bridge. In the outwork was a sallyport corresponding to the postern of the castle, and the whole was surrounded by a strong palisade. Rebecca could observe, from the number of men placed for the defence of this post, that the besieged entertained apprehensions for its safety, and from the mustering of the assailants in a direction nearly opposite to the outwork, it seemed no less plain that it had been selected as a vulnerable point of attack. These appearances she hastily communicated to Ivanhoe, and added, "The skirts of the wood seem lined with archers, although only a few are advanced from its dark shadow."
"Under what banner?" asked Ivanhoe.
"Under no ensign of war which I can observe," answered Rebecca.
"A Selkirth novelty," muttered the knight, "to advance to storm such a castle without pennon or banner displayed. Seest thou who they be that act as leaders?"
"A knight clad in sable armour is the most conspicuous," said the Jewess. "He alone is armed from head to heel, and seems to assume the direction of all around him."
"What device does he bear on his shield?" replied Ivanhoe.
"Something resembling a bar of iron with a padlock painted blue on the black shield."
"A fetterlock and shacklebolt azure," said Ivanhoe. "I know not who may bear that device, but well I ween it might now be mine own. Canst thou not see the motto?"
"Scarce the device itself at this distance," replied Rebecca. "But when the sun glances fair upon his shield, it seems as I tell you."
"Seem there no other leaders?" continued the anxious inquirer.
"None of mark and distinction that I can behold from this station," said Rebecca. "But doubtless the other side of the castle is also assailed. They seem even now preparing to advance. God of Zion, protect us. What a dreadful sight. Those who advance first bear huge shields and defences made of plank. The others follow, bending their bows as they come on. They raise their bows. God of Moses, forgive the creatures thou hast made."
Her description was here suddenly interrupted by the signal for assault, which was given by the blast of a shrill bugle, and at once answered by a flourish of the Norman trumpets from the battlements, which, mingled with the deep and hollow clang of the nakers, a species of kettle drum, retorted in notes of defiance the challenge of the enemy. The shouts of both parties augmented the fearful din, the assailants crying, "St. George for England!" and the Normans answering them with cries of, "En avant de Bracy! Beauséant! Beauséant! Front de Boeuf à la Récousse!" according to the war cries of their different commanders. It was not, however, by clamour that the contest was to be decided, and the desperate efforts of the assailants were met by an equally vigorous defence on the part of the besieged. The archers, trained by their woodland pastimes to the most effective use of the longbow, shot, to use the appropriate phrase of the time, so wholly together that no point at which a defender could show the least part of his person escaped their clothyard shafts. By this heavy discharge, which continued as thick and sharp as hail, while notwithstanding every arrow had its individual aim, and flew by scores together against each embrasure and opening in the parapets, as well as at every window where a defender either actually had post or might be suspected to be stationed, by this sustained discharge, two or three of the garrison were slain and several others wounded. But confident in their armour of proof, and in the cover which their situation afforded, the followers of Front de Boeuf and his allies showed an obstinacy in defence proportioned to the fury of the attack, replied with the discharge of their large crossbows, as well as with longbows, slings, and other missiles, to the close and continued shower of arrows, and, as the assailants were necessarily but indifferently protected, did considerably more damage than they received at their hand. The whizzing of shafts and of missiles on both sides was only interrupted by the shouts which arose when either side inflicted or sustained some notable loss.
"And I must lie here like a bedridden monk," exclaimed Ivanhoe, "while the game that gives me freedom or death is played out by the hand of others. Look from the window once again, kind maiden, but beware that you are not marked by the archers beneath. Look out once more, and tell me if they yet advance to the storm."
With patient courage, strengthened by the interval which she had employed in mental devotion, Rebecca again took post at the lattice. sheltering herself, however, so as not to be visible from beneath. "What's to thou see, Rebecca?" again demanded the wounded knight. "Nothing but the cloud of arrows flying so thick as to dazzle mine eyes, and to hide the bowmen who shoot them."
"That cannot endure," said Ivanhoe. "If they press not right on to carry the castle by pure force of arms, the archery may avail but little against stone walls and bulwarks. Look for the knight of the Fetterlock, fair Rebecca, and see how he bears himself, for as the leader is, so will his followers be."
"I see him not," said Rebecca.
"Foul craven," exclaimed Ivanhoe. "Does he blench from the helm when the wind blows highest?"
"He blenches not, he blenches not," said Rebecca. "I see him now. He heads a body of men close under the outer barrier of the barbican. They pull down the piles and palisades. They hew down the barriers with axes. His high black plume floats abroad over the throng like a raven over the field of the slain. They have made a breach in the barriers. They rush in. They are thrust back. Front de Boeuf heads the defenders. I see his gigantic form above the press. They throng again to the breach, and the pass is disputed hand to hand and man to man. God of Jacob, it is the meeting of two fierce tides, the conflict of two oceans moved by adverse winds." She turned her head from the lattice, as if unable longer to endure a sight so terrible. "Look forth again, Rebecca," said Ivanhoe, mistaking the cause of her retiring. "The archery must in some degree have ceased, since they are now fighting hand to hand. Look again, there is now less danger." Rebecca again looked forth, and almost immediately exclaimed, "Holy prophets of the law! Front de Boeuf and the Black Knight fight hand to hand on the breach, amid the roar of their followers who watch the progress of the strife. Heaven strike with the cause of the oppressed and of the captive." She then uttered a loud shriek and exclaimed, "He is down! He is down!"
"Who is down?" cried Ivanhoe. "For our dear lady's sake, tell me which has fallen."
"The Black Knight," answered Rebecca faintly, then instantly again shouted with joyful eagerness, But no, the name of the Lord of Hosts be blessed. He is on foot again, and fights as if there were 20 men's strength in his single arm. His sword is broken. He snatches an axe from a yeoman. He presses Front de Boeuf with blow on blow. The giant stoops and totters like an oak under the steel of the woodman. He falls! He falls!
"Front de Boeuf!" exclaimed Ivanhoe.
"Front de Boeuf!" answered the Jewess. "His men rush to the rescue, headed by the haughty Templar. Their united force compels the champion to pause. They drag Front de Boeuf within the walls."
"The assailants have won the barriers, have they not?" said Ivanhoe.
They have, and they press the besieged hard upon the outer wall. Some plant ladders, some swarm like bees, and endeavour to ascend upon the shoulders of each other. Down go stones, beams, and trunks of trees upon their heads, and as fast as they bear the wounded to the rear, fresh men supply their place in the assault. Great God, hast thou given men thine own image that it should be thus cruelly defaced by the hands of their brethren?"
"Think not of that," replied Ivanhoe. "This is no time for such thoughts. Who yield? Who push their way?"
"The ladders are thrown down," replied Rebecca, shuddering. "The soldiers lie grovelling under them like crushed reptiles. The besieged have the better."
"St. George, strike for us," said the knight. "Do the false yeomen give way?"
"No," exclaimed Rebecca. "They bear themselves right yeomanly. The Black Knight approaches the postern with his huge axe. The thundering blows which he deals, you may hear them above all the din and shouts of the battle. Stones and beams are hailed down on the bold champion. He regards them no more than if they were thistledown or feathers."
"By St. John of Acre," said Ivanhoe, raising himself joyfully on his couch, "methought there was but one man in England that might do such a deed."
"The postern gate shakes," continued Rebecca. "It crashes. It is splintered by his blows. It is broken down. They rush in. The outwork is won. Oh, God, they hurl the defenders from the battlements. They drive them into the moat. Oh, men, if ye be indeed men, spare them that can resist no longer."
The bridge which communicates with the castle, have they won that pass?" exclaimed Ivanhoe.
"No," replied Rebecca. "The Templar has destroyed the plank on which they crossed. Few of the defenders escaped with him into the castle. The shrieks and cries which you hear tell the doom of the others. Alas, I see that it is still more difficult to look upon victory than upon battle."
"What do they do now, maiden?" said Ivanhoe. "Look forth yet again. This is no time to faint at bloodshed."
"It is over for the time," said Rebecca. "Our friends strengthen themselves within the outwork which they have mastered, and it affords them so good a shelter from the foeman's shot that the garrison only bestows a few bolts on it from interval to interval, as if rather to disquiet than effectually injure them."
"Our friends," said Wilfred, "will surely not abandon an enterprise so gloriously begun and an advantage so happily attained. Oh, no, I will put my faith in the good knight whose axe has rent heart of oak and bars of iron." "Singular," he again muttered to himself, "if there be two who can do a deed of such daring do. A fetterlock and a shacklebolt on a field sable, what may that mean? Seest thou naught else, Rebecca, by which the Black Knight may be distinguished?"